6.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice.
His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
Plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet,
they're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Cancel the Cabal with Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
Okay, and welcome back to another Tuesday afternoon, everyone, at Shake and Wake Radio. This is Cancel the Cabal, and I'm Stephen Roberts. Seem to be down some listeners this week, only 18 in chat. Normally about, 27, 28, somewhere in there. Maybe lost a bunch of listeners since the other book reading. I don't know. But we're going to continue on anyways. I'm going to go back one paragraph to go back over the end of last week's reading. Illness has followed 5G installation in all major cities in America, starting with New York in the fall of 2019 in Manhattan, along with parts of Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Queens. All subsequent coronavirus hotspots, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Dallas, Cleveland, and Atlanta soon followed. With some 5,000 towns and cities now covered, citizens of the small country of San Marino, first country in the world to install 5G in September 2018, have had the longest exposure to 5G and the highest infection rate, four times higher than Italy, which deployed 5G in June 2019, and 27 times higher than Croatia, which has not deployed 5G in rural areas. The illness blamed on the coronavirus is slight to non-existent. Okay, that's good, Andy. But, looks like we picked up three since I went on air. Who knows? But I do want to mention that Shake and Wake is listener-supported. PSN Radio is listener supported, and so is SoFlow Radio, as well as myself. We're all listener supported. In Europe, illness is highly correlated with 5G rollout. For example, Milan and other areas in northern Italy have the densest 5G coverage, and northern Italy has 22 times as many coronavirus cases as Rome. In Switzerland, telecommunications companies have built more than 2,000 antennas, but the Swiss have halted at least some of the 5G rollout due to health concerns. Switzerland has had far fewer coronavirus cases than nearby France, Spain, and Germany, where 5G is going full steam ahead. I don't know. I just had some concerns. He's talking about this coronavirus. I could have swore I've heard him say some things like, you know, viruses don't exist. Viruses aren't proven to exist because they can't isolate them from Koch's postulates. And, I don't know. It seems like I've heard him say that. Anyways, not totally sure. Iran announced an official 5G launch in late March 2020, but assuming pre-launch testing in February, the advent of 5G correlates with the first COVID-19 cases at the same time. Korea has installed over 70,000 5G bases and reported over 8,000 cases of illness by mid-March. Japan began testing 5G in tunnels in Hokkaido, whatever that word is. It's a city or a town or something. In early February 2020, and this city now has the most cases of coronavirus in Japan, even more than Tokyo. Yeah, 25. It picked up some listeners, Andy. I don't know where they came from, and I don't really care, but I'm glad everybody's here. In South America, the 5G rollout has occurred in Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, and Mexico, all of which have many coronavirus cases. Countries without 5G, such as Guyana, Suriname, It looks like Guyana also, but it's spelled differently. Oh well, G-U-I-A-N-A. And Paraguay have not reported any cases. Paraguay is doing what all countries should do, building a national fiber optic network without resorting to 5G. In South America, the 5G rollout, I just read that, sorry. Bartomeu Payaras. Cifre, a Spanish epidemiologist, has charted the rollout of 5G in European cities and countries with cases per thousand people, and demonstrated a clear and close relationship between the rate of coronavirus infections and the 5G antenna location. What about COVID-19 in the Arizona Basin? The Pan American Health Organization, PAHO, estimates that there are at least 20,000 active coronavirus cases among the indigenous people. They live in primitive lifestyle, but 5G is already there, along with 25,000 enormous powerful surveillance radars, 10 Doppler weather radars, 200 floating water monitoring stations, 900 radio-equipped listening posts, 32 radio stations. Eight airborne state-of-the-art surveillance jets equipped with fog-penetrating radar. 99 attack trainer support aircraft, all of which can track individual human beings and hear a twig snap anywhere in the Amazon. These were installed in 2002 as part of the System for Vigilance of the Amazon, SIVAM, which monitors activities in a 2 million square mile area of remote wilderness. All life in the Amazon is bathed with a range of electromagnetic frequencies. These 5G frequencies go only a short distance and cannot penetrate into buildings. However, a few tech startups are working to get 5G signal into the areas where we work, play, and sleep. Pivotal Comware is testing an Echo 5G in building penetration device. Pivotal's offices are about 1 mile from the Life Care Nursing Home in Kirkland, Washington, where the illness first appeared in the United States, and where 25 residents died. Was the Life Care Center a testing ground for Pivotal's new device? Healthcare facilities also teem with electronic equipment, some of it located right by the heads of sick patients. People who suffer from electromagnetic hypersensitivity cannot go near hospitals and nursing homes. The 5G system is also installed on modern cruise ships. For example, the Diamond Princess cruise ship advertises the best Wi-Fi at sea. On February 3, 2020, the ship was quarantined in Yokohama, Japan, after many passengers complained of illness. At the end, 381 passengers and crew members became sick, and 14 died. Let's see here. Of interest is the fact that the military has crowd control devices that operate at the same ranges, 6 to 100 gigahertz. The 95 gigahertz active denial system is a weapon that can penetrate the skin and produce intolerable heating sensations, causing people to move away from the beam. The Europa EMF guideline 2016 states, there is strong evidence that long-term exposure to certain EMFs is a risk factor for diseases such as certain cancers, Alzheimer's disease, and male infertility. Common electromagnetic hypersensitivity symptoms include headaches, concentration difficulties, sleep problems, depression, lack of energy, fatigue, and flu-like symptoms. Yeah, I've got all those. Except for the headaches. I don't really get the headaches. I'll take them if I can get rid of all the rest of that stuff. Man. I'll take headaches, but not migraines. That's for sure. An article published in May 2020 in Toxicology Letters found that in real-world conditions, exposure to wide-spectrum non-ionizing frequencies adversely impact skin, eyes, heart, liver, kidney, spleen, blood, and bone marrow. I've got a lot of those. Electromagnetic frequencies also disturb the immune function through stimulation of various allergic and inflammatory responses, and they adversely affect tissue repair. The Russians studied the effects of millimeter waves on animals and humans in 1979. Workers servicing ultra-high frequency generators complained of fatigue, drowsiness, headaches, and loss of memory. The blood was particularly affected, with a reduction in the amount of hemoglobin and the tendency towards hypercoagulation. Even earlier in 1971, the U.S. Naval Medical Research Institute published more than 2,300 references in the bibliography of reported biological phenomena effects and clinical manifestations attributed to microwave and radio frequency radiation. They found adverse effects almost everywhere in the body, in addition to generalized degeneration of all body tissue. They noted altered sex ratios of births, more girls, altered fetal development, decreased lactation in nursing mothers, seizures, convulsions, anxiety, thyroid enlargement, decreased testosterone production, and of particular interest, sparking between dental fillings and a particular metallic taste in the mouth. One research review of almost 200 studies noted non-thermal effects have been clearly demonstrated in thousands of peer-reviewed publications. Whereas some EMF frequency band patterns are coherent and may be health-promoting, the chosen 5G frequencies belong for a great part to the detrimental zones. The authors of the fact that 5G radiation can be pulsing and modulating and emitted from multiple antennas of interest is the finding that EMF waves can be circularly polarized by interaction with atmospheric dust and therefore may penetrate much deeper into the organism. In addition, 5G waves may exhibit interference with other EMF wave frequencies, resulting in standing waves and environmental hotspots of radiation that can be very taxing on EMF hypersensitivity individuals. Air pollution and 5G are not a good mix. Well, that's wonderful. A study published in Frontiers in Oncology describes lung injury from radiation therapy. Radiation therapy uses shorter waves at close range for a shorter period of time, but it stands to reason that a 5G millimeter waves with transmitters nearby pulsing massive amounts of frequency at all times could also cause lung injury. According to the authors, depending on the dose and the volume of lung irradiated, acute irradiation pneumonitis may develop, characterized by dry cough and dyspnea, shortness of breath. That's what I have. And they're calling it COPD. Of interest is the fact that Lloyd's of London and other insurance carriers won't cover injury from cell phones, Wi-Fi, or smart meters. EMFs are classified as a pollutant alongside smoke, chemicals, and asbestos. Electromagnetic fields exclusion is a general insurance exclusion and is applied across the market as standard. The purpose of the exclusion is to exclude cover from illnesses caused by continuous long-term non-ionizing radiation exposure, i.e., through mobile phone usage. Yeah, sorry, Sarah. I feel for you. Well, at least that's what they tell me I have anyways. I wonder if COPD is one of those things that they don't really have a clue what you have, so they call it COPD. Kind of like, what is that, chronic fatigue syndrome? I don't know. Or maybe they just call it COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, because of the 5G, the 5G effects. As we've read in a couple of books now, the first book, it keeps you from breathing effectively. According to Dr. Cameron Kyle Seidel, working in an emergency room in New York, the afflicted are literally gasping for air. Yeah. We've never seen anything like it, he said. COVID-19 patients' symptoms resemble those of high altitude sickness. There we go. Rather than viral pneumonia. Dry cough and it's hard to breathe. It sounds just like altitude sickness. In fact, the ventilators that the hospitals have scrambled to obtain may do more harm than good and may be accounting for the high mortality rate. Yeah, we've already heard that last 2.5 years. As they increase pressure on the lungs. These patients don't need help breathing. They need more oxygen when they take a breath. Many turn blue in the face. These are not signs of a contagious disease, but of disruption of our mechanisms for producing energy and getting oxygen to the red blood cells. Who knows, Amy? Who knows? Remember that during the Spanish flu, the problems was the lack of blood coagulating. With COVID-19, a key problem is lack of oxygen in the blood. Both conditions point to electric toxicity rather than infection. Iron-rich blood cells would be especially vulnerable to the effects of electromagnetism. And there's another symptom. Fizzing. Many COVID patients report strange buzzing sensations throughout their body. An electric feeling on the skin. Or skin that feels like it's burning. Those who are electrically sensitive report similar sensations when they are near a cell phone or use GPS guided cruise control in their cars. Other symptoms include loss of smell, taste, fever, aches, breathlessness, fatigue, dry cough, diarrhea, strokes, and seizures, all of which are also reported by those who are electrically sensitive. The correlation of 5G rollout in COVID-19 cases and the similarity of symptoms should give us pause. Shouldn't we look more closely before we institute mandatory vaccination and electronic ID chipping? Shouldn't we test to see whether this virus is actually contagious before we mandate social distancing and prescribe face masks? Today's pandemic raises many questions. What makes some people more vulnerable than others to the effects of 5G? Why did 35 sailors on the battleship Arachne? A-R-A-C-H-N-E, Arachne, not get sick? Which environmental factors weaken our defenses? How would we treat this disease if it is not a viral disease? What about our diets? Can we protect ourselves with the right food choices? Well, we will address these questions in subsequent chapters. Most important, we will show the minute particles called viruses. The minute particles called viruses are actually exosomes, not invaders, but toxic goblin messengers that our cells can produce to help us adjust to environmental assaults, including electrosmog. After all, most people have adjusted to worldwide radio waves, electricity in our homes, and ubiquitous Wi-Fi, and the sparrow population rebounded after the flu in 1738. exosomes are what allow this to happen. These tiny messengers provide real-time and rapid genetic adaptation to environmental changes. Whether those exosomes can help us adapt to the extreme disruption of 5G is the question of the day. Chapter 3, Pandemics. Throughout history, philosophers believed that comets were harbingers of doom, disease, and death, infecting men with bloodlust to war, contaminating crops, and dispersing disease and plague. The Chinese textbook Mawangdu Silk details 29 types of comets dating back to 1500 BC. And the disasters that followed each one. Comets are vile stars, wrote a Chinese official in 648 AD. Every time they appear in the south, they wipe out the old and establish the new. Fish grow sick, crops fail, emperors and common people die, and men go to war. The people hate life and don't want to speak of it. In medieval Europe, and even in colonial America, observers associated the appearance of comets with the onset of disease. In the summer of 536 AD, a mysterious and dramatic cloud of dust appeared over the Mediterranean and for 18 months darkened the sky as far as China. According to the Byzantine historian Procopius, during this year a most dread portent took place. For the sun gave forth its light without brightness, and it seemed exceedingly like the sun in eclipse, for the beams it shed were not clear. Analysis of Greenland ice deposited between 533 and 540 AD shows high levels of tin, nickel, and iron oxides, suggesting that a comet or fragment of a comet may have hit the Earth at that time. The impact likely triggered volcanic eruptions, which spewed more dust into the atmosphere. With the darkened sky, temperatures dropped, crops failed, and famine descended on many parts of the world. Okay, I finished that page just in time for the first break. So, let's see. I don't know. I guess about a 6-minute break, everyone.
Well, I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're back at the break there. Got 6 minute song. I hope everybody likes all the songs that I play. Most of them are Gaither band, Gaither singing group, for the most part. Shortly afterward, in 541 AD, a mysterious illness began to appear on the outskirts of the Byzantine Empire. Victims suffered from delusions, nightmares, and fevers. They had lymph node swellings in the groin, armpits, and behind the ears. The plague, named after the reigning emperor Justinian, arrived in Constantinople in 542. Procopius noted their bodies were left stacked in an open due to a lack of space for proper burial. He estimated that in the city at its peak, the plague was killing 10,000 people per day. All right, thanks everyone. The current explanation for the correlation of comets and disease is that of panspermia. We know now that outer space is populated by clouds and microorganisms, and the theory holds that comets are watery bodies, not dirty snowballs, that rain new microscopic forms on the earth to which humans and animals have no immunity. However, recent evidence indicates little, if any, water on the comets, rather than However, recent evidence indicates little, if any, water on comets. Rather, they are asteroids that have had elliptical orbit and often charged electrically as they approach the sun, an exchange that creates a comet's bright coma and tail. Commas with two M's. This is coma. C-O-M-A, coma, and tail. Their surfaces exhibit the kind of features that happen when intense electrical arcing, like craters and cliffs, bright or shiny spots, on otherwise barren, rocky surfaces, indicate areas that are electrically charged. Comets contain mineral alloys requiring temperatures in their thousands of degrees, and they have sufficient energy to emit extreme UV light and even powerful X-rays. Moreover, as comets approach the sun, they can provoke high-energy discharges and flare-ups of solar plasma, which reach out to the comet. Thus, comets can create electrical disturbances in the atmosphere, even more powerful than those created by man-made electrification. And all radiation includes demonstrably dangerous ionizing radiation. No wonder the ancients were afraid of comets. The conventional view holds that the plague of Justinian was a case of bubonic plague. Researchers analyzed the remains from graves of the period and detected DNA from Yersinia pestis. Mainstream thinking has concluded that rats and other rodents carry Yersinia pestis and pass it along to fleas. When rats die, the blood-sucking fleas leave them to prey on other rats, dogs, and humans. The bacteria then enter humans via flea bites. Researchers believe that during the time of Justinian, rats on merchant ships carried the microorganism to the other Mediterranean ports. Hang on a second here. I'm going to put some other... There we go. Just need to put a video on so my screen doesn't go black. And one video ended, so I went to another. The classic sign of bubonic plague are buboes. B-U-B-O-E-S. Buboes. Badly swollen lymph nodes. These often appear in the groin because, according to conventional thinking, most flea bites occur on the leg. Those infected will first experience fevers, chills, muscle pains, before developing septicemia or pneumonia. The plague reappeared at periodic intervals over the next 300 years, with the last recorded occurrence in 750 AD, possibly explained by a still-orbiting comet debris. It eventually claimed 25% of the inhabitants in the Mediterranean region. Then the plague disappeared from Europe until the Black Death of the 14th century, also presaged by a comet. According to historian Thomas Short, In France was seen the terrible comet called Negra. In December appeared over Avignon, a pillar of fire. There were many great earthquakes, tempests, thunders, and lightnings, and thousands of people were swallowed up. The courses of rivers were stopped. Some chasms of the earth sent forth blood. Terrible showers of hail. Each stone weighed 1 pound to 8 pounds. Wow. Abortions to all countries. In Germany, it rained blood. In France, blood gushed out of the graves of the dead and stained the rivers crimson. Comets, meteors, fire beams, and coruscations in the air. Mock suns, the heavens of fire. According to textbooks, sounds almost biblical, apocalyptic. According to textbooks, the same bubonic plague organism of Justinian's time caused the Black Death of Europe, 1347 to 1350. However, more investigations have pointed out flaws in this theory. Although researchers found evidence of Yersinia pestis in dental pulp from a mass grave of the period in France, other teams of scientists were unable to find evidence of the pathogen in 5 other graves sites of the period from other parts of Europe. Sociologist Susan Scott and biologist Christopher J. Duncan claim that a hemorrhagic fever, similar to the Ebola virus, caused the Black Death. Others blame anthrax and some now extinct disease. They note that medieval accounts don't square with modern descriptions of the illness. Witnesses described the disease that spread at great speed with very high mortality. Unlike the plague, which moved slowly and had a death rate of about 60%. Accounts describe buboes covering the entire body rather than limited to the groin areas as in the case of plague. Symptom descriptions mention awful odors, splotches resembling bruises, delirium, and stupor. None of which happened with modern-day bubonic plague. Some critics have embraced the theory that a virus caused the disease, but this premise hardly provides a better explanation than does bacteria. To explain the disease, the disease's rapid spread and high mortality. Then there is a rat problem. No written documents from the time describe vast legions of dead rats required to explain the plague. The Black Death killed over half of Iceland's population, but rats didn't reach Iceland until the 19th century. And the Black Death continued to kill people during the winter months in northern Europe, despite the fact that the plague organism requires relatively warm temperatures. In new light of the Black Death, the cosmic connection, Professor Mike Bailey argues that a comet caused the pandemic. He points out that witnesses of the period describe a significant earthquake on January 25, 1348, with other earthquakes to follow. There have been masses of dead fish, animals, and other things along the seashore, and in many places covered in dust, wrote a contemporary observer. And all these things seem to have come from a greater corruption of the air and earth. Other documents describe tidal waves, rains of fire, foul odors, strange odors in the sky, mist, and even dragons, in addition to earthquakes. Bailey believes that fragments of Comet Negra, which passed by Earth in 1347, caused the atmospheric phenomena. Some fragments descended to and injected huge amounts of dust into the atmosphere. Tree ring analysis indicates that the material ascended from space. It spewed large amounts of chemicals based on carbon and nitrogen into the atmosphere. According to Bailey, illness and death resulted from poisoned water and air as a comet flew overhead. But these symptoms, especially bruise-like blotches on the skin and high fatality rate, indicate radiation poisoning, probably rendered even more deadly than by dust and ammonia-like compounds in the atmosphere. Imagine a large comet passing over near the Earth and crackling with intense electric arcing, pelting the Earth with X-rays and casting off fragments that fall to the earth and spew up toxic clouds of dust, followed immediately by horrible death, sometimes wiping out whole towns. This is not the kind of catastrophe that we can blame on microbes. Perhaps our solar system is calming down. Mankind has not seen such violent phenomena for centuries. But smaller electrical disturbances, ones that can't be seen, are still likely to promote outbreaks, albeit less disastrous. And if radiation poisoning, whether ionizing or non-ionizing, provokes disease, there are obvious cofactors: poisons in air, water, and food, toxins from insect bites, deadly fungi on grains, exposure to filth, malnutrition, and starvation, as well as fear and despair. We don't need to resort to the notion of contagion to explain outbreaks of disease. Let us consider insect-borne diseases. Many, if not most, biting or stinging insects release toxins, often complex chemicals that can target the nervous system. Wasps, bees, flies, beetles, mosquitoes, ticks, bedbugs, lice, and ants all produce poisonous substances. Early studies suggest that insect saliva has chemicals with vesicolate Vasodilarity, and anticoagulating and immunosuppressant properties. Although in recent times there has been little interest or research money for the study of insect saliva. They don't want to study it because they might find a causation. Who knows? I don't know. In addition to overt poisons, insect saliva may contain parasite eggs. Tapeworms can be transmitted by fleas, and mosquito bites contain the eggs of Plasmodium, a parasite said to cause malaria. Mosquitoes also carry fly larvae, which can enter the body through bites, causing miasis, a parasitic infection of the body by fly larvae, maggots, which grow inside the host. Some mosquito species can carry filariasis, a parasite that causes a disfiguring condition called elephantitis. These diseases are infectious in the sense that people can acquire them from something outside the body, such as an insect. But only in the most bizarre circumstances can they be transmitted from one human being to another. Actually, scientists have yet to solve the mystery of malaria, a disease that kills over 100,000 people per day.
Wow.
The conventional view is that mosquitoes in tropical and subtropical regions transfer a parasite to human blood through their bites. And this parasite then destroys red blood cells and causes intermittent fever. But the type of mosquito said to carry malaria inhabits every continent except Antarctica, including Europe and North America, where malaria is no longer a problem. From the 15th century, until recent times, many people in England suffered from malaria under the name of marsh fever or ague, A-G-U-E. I guess that's how you would say that. Ague. Always associated with living in swampy marshes. In fact, what is common to areas known for malaria, both today and in the past, is human habitation in swamps and wetlands. And not just warm wetlands, which are conductive to mosquitoes, but also wetlands in cooler areas, such as England. Wetlands produce swamp gases, a mixture of hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, and especially methane. Methane poisoning causes fever, headaches, muscle weakness, nausea, vomiting, and feelings of asphyxiation. Remarkably similar to the symptoms of malaria, fever, muscle weakness, nausea, vomiting, and chest and abdominal pain. Like malaria, methane poisoning can result in the destruction of red blood cells. In areas of the world where people still live in swampy areas, intermittent exposure to swamp gases, which are undoubtedly stronger during warm weather or flooding season, seems a better explanation than mosquitoes for this stubborn disease. The conventional view holds that viral diseases such as yellow fever, dengue fever, Zika fever, and chikungunya are transmitted by mosquitoes carrying viruses that attach to the enter-susceptible cells. According to textbooks, once these viruses enter the body and begin to replicate inside the cells, they are contagious and are spread from person to person through airborne droplets, sexual contact, eating food, and drinking water contaminated with the virus.
and even touching surfaces on bodily fluids contaminated with the virus. But we don't need the concepts. Of viruses and contagion to explain these diseases. Environments infested with fleas, mosquitoes, lice, and other insects carrying toxins or parasites will result in many individuals, especially individuals with suboptimal nutrition, manifesting similar symptoms, an outbreak that requires no premise of person-to-person contact. Only many people subject to the same stressors. For example, the outbreak of Zika virus, blamed for a rash of babies born with tragically small heads, formed an experiment that gave prenatal ultrasounds of increasing intensity, duration, and frequency to thousands of pregnant women in Brazil. Toxins are powerful stressors. Sewage fumes contain a mixture of toxic gaseous compounds, such as hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, methane, and ammonia. High concentrations of methane and carbon dioxide displace oxygen. In conditions of low oxygen, beneficial fermentative bacteria began producing toxins instead of helpful compounds. Industrial chemicals in sewage can add to the adverse effects, especially if those toxins make their way into drinking water. In times past, these toxins included mercury, arsenic, and lead. Lead used for roofing, tanks, gutters, pipes, cables, and winemaking, and even added to recipes in Roman times. Poison directly through drinking water, or through the skin. Renaissance noblewomen wore makeup containing white lead, or white lead ore, ERE, vinegar, arsenic, hydroxide, and carbonate. Applied to the face over egg whites or a mercury foundation, the arsenic face powder was the crowning touch. The price for a flawless complexion was paralysis, madness, and death. That's a good place for a break, I would think. Talk about the 17th century women and what they had to deal with, I guess. I can mark my spot here. Get a different pen. That one don't seem to be working. Okay. And, time for another break, everyone. So, let's see here. I guess about a 5-minute song.
Could see what I once was. If you could go with me back to where I started from, then I know you would see a miracle of love. And made me what I am today.
Okay, everyone, welcome back. And I do want to say this at the beginning of the second hour here, beginning of the final hour, so all of the stations are listener-supported. I hope we can continue to do this on Shake and Wake and the other stations, but things are only going to get tougher for people. It's getting tougher for me every single month. Trying to make it through just on disability. And I really dread having to try to ask people for help, too. Some people enjoy it, but I don't. Leather tanning contributed greatly to water pollution. Lime tanning, animal dung, urine, alum, and arsenic were used in the process. The Industrial Revolution added toxic chromium solution to the mix. Production of red paint and dyes, metal extraction, and caustic soda production released mercury. Both mercury and arsenic were popular ingredients in medicines, and they have no doubt carried off as many people as the diseases themselves. The severe vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration, and muscle cramping of cholera is blamed on the bacterium cholerae, either from sewage tainted water or shellfish like oysters living in the sewage tainted water. Actually, the killer is a toxin called cholera toxin, CT, which the bacteria produce under low oxygen conditions through cholera toxin can be deadly. It also has anti-inflammatory properties and has shown promise as a immunotherapeutic drug. Cholera affects up
to 5 million people, mostly in third world countries, and causes over 100,000 deaths per year. Treatment includes oral rehydration therapy and zinc supplementation. Children are highly susceptible to CT, as are those who are malnourished or have lower immunity. One strange observation is the fact that type O blood types are more likely to contract cholera. Even today, with the medical world's fixation on person-to-person transmission of disease and prevention through vaccination, health authorities agree that the solution to cholera is better sanitation. Cholera is rarely spread directly from person to person, but only through filthy drinking water. An outbreak of cholera occurred in Soho, London, in 1854, according to Judith Summers in Broad Street Pump Outbreak. By the middle of the 19th century, Soho had become an insanitary place of cow sheds, animal droppings, slaughterhouses, grease boiling dens, and primitive decaying sewers. And underneath the floorboards of the overcrowded cellars lurked something even worse, a fetal sea of cesspits as old as the houses, and many of which had never been drained. It was only a matter of time before this hidden festering time bomb exploded. The previous year, over 10,000 people died of cholera in England. The outbreak in Soho apparently appeared suddenly. Few families, rich or poor, were spared the loss of at least one member. Within a week, three-quarters of the residents had fled from their homes, leaving their shops shuttered, their homes locked, and the streets deserted. Only those who could not afford to leave remained there. It was like the Great Plague all over again. Dr. John Snow lived in the corner of the outbreak and traced the source to the pump on the corner of Broad and Cambridge Streets at the epicenter of the epidemic. I found, he wrote afterwards, that nearly all the deaths had taken place within a short distance of the pump. In fact, in houses much nearer another pump, only 10 deaths occurred, and of those, 5 victims had drunk the water from the Broad Street pump. Workers in the local brewery did not get sick. They drank beer provided as a perk of employment. Yeah, boiled the water, made it into a beer, killed all the microbes and all the germs. Dr. Snow blamed the outbreak not on toxins, but on white flocculent particles, which he observed under the microscope. 3 decades later, Robert Koch tried injecting a culture of these white flocculent particles into animals without succeeding in getting them sick. So cholera failed his second postulate. Cholera also failed his first postulate, as vibrio-cholerae appeared in both sick and healthy people. Even so, he remained convinced that this bacillus was the cause of the cholera. Old ideas are difficult to dislodge, even in the face of conflicting evidence. It bears emphasis that all cities up to the 19th century were fetid seas of horse droppings, stinking manure piles, primitive water sanitation, toxic chemicals, crowded living conditions, loose pigs, and even raw sewage dumped from houses. Swill from inner-city breweries went to cows in their inner-city confinement dairies, produced poisoned milk in conditions of unimaginable filth. The death rate among children born in these conditions was 50%. Officials blamed the death rate on the milk, which became the justification for pasteurization laws, instituted 150 years later. By then, the problem had resolved itself with improved water and sewer systems, better living conditions, the advent of refrigeration, laws prohibiting inner-city breweries and dairies, and most important, replacement of the horse with the car. Automobiles and buses brought in a different kind of pollution, but new technologies at least ensure that the water was finally clean. Much infectious disease cleared up thanks to doctors rather than inventors and civil engineers. One invention that made life safer was the washing machine, making it easier to keep clothes and bedding clean, especially as more and more dwellings had hot running water. Another invention was the vacuum cleaner, which helped keep living quarters free of bugs. Window screens also helped. At the turn of the 20th century, health officials considered smallpox to be highly infectious. But one physician disagreed. Dr. Charles A. R. Campbell of San Antonio, Texas, believed that smallpox was transmitted by the bites of bedbugs. The modern official view holds that smallpox resulted from contact with a contagious virus. Transmission occurred through inhalation of airborne variola virus, usually droplets expressed from the oral, nasal, or pharyngeal mucus of the infected person. It was transmitted from one person to another primarily through prolonged face-to-face contact with an infected person, usually within a distance of 1.8 meters, 6 feet, but could also be spread through direct contact with infected bodily fluids or contaminated objects, such as bedding or clothes. The infected person was contagious until the smallpox scab fell off. Smallpox was not known to be transmitted by insects or animals. Note that this description is written in the past tense. The official view is that smallpox has been conquered by vaccination, not by something as simple as getting rid of bedbugs. Dr. Campbell ran a pest house for smallpox patients in San Antonio, where he tried hard to infect himself and others by fomites and direct face-to-face contact with infected persons. And this is from Dr. Campbell. As even the air itself without contact is considered sufficient to convey this disease, and touching the clothes of a smallpox patient is considered equivalent to contact to contract it. I exposed myself with the same impunity as my pest housekeeper. After numerous exposures made in the ordinary manner, by ongoing from house to house where the disease was, I have never conveyed this disease to my family or to any of the patients or friends. Although I did not disinfect myself or my clothes, nor take my precautions whatever except to be sure that no bedbugs got on my clothing. I'd like to know how he did that. another one of my experiments was thoroughly to beat a rug in a room only 8 or 10 feet square, for which had just been removed a smallpox patient. I beat this rug in the room until the air was stifling and remained therein for 30 minutes. This represented the respiratory as well as the digestive system as accepted avenues of infection. After inhaling the dust from the rug, I examined my sputum microscopically and the following morning and found cotton and woolen fibers, pollen, and contaminated manure, and also bacteria of many kinds. Although Dr. Campbell subsequently mingled with families, patients, and friends, none contracted smallpox. He repeated these experiments with others, failing to infect even when in contact with patients covered in sores. But he always found bedbugs in the houses of those contracted the disease. The British and American colonists used smallpox as a weapon against the Native Americans. They did it by giving them blankets, thus spread the bedbug into the New World. Campbell treated smallpox as administering sources of vitamin C. Yummy. Oh. Yummy indeed, Mark. And Dr. Campbell again, his words. The most important observation of the medieval aspect of this disease is the bad condition with which it is associated, and which is actually the soil requisite for its different degrees of virulence. I refer to the scorbutic coccidia. Yeah. Among the lower classes of people, this particular acquainted constitutional perversion of nutrition is most prevalent, primarily on account of their poverty, but also because of the fact that they care little or nothing for fruits or vegetables. This is more prevalent in winter, when the anti-scorbutics are scarce and high-priced. And finally, that the removal of this perversion of nutrition will so mitigate the virulence of this malady as positively to prevent the pitting or pocketing of smallpox. A failure of the fruit crop, or in any particular large area, is always followed the succeeding winter by the presence of smallpox. Dr. Campbell also applied himself to the elimination of mosquitoes by constructing huge bat houses. He was a great admirer of this strange winged creature and knew how to harness its help in the elimination of annoying insects assumed to cause malaria. Campbell was an inventive and colorful character, full of good ideas, yet hardly mentioned in medical journals or in histories of disease. Where's the glamour of a solution that involves clean beds and fresh fruits compared to the heroics of vaccination, Smallpox vaccinations are so toxic that health officials no longer recommend them. Unlike the forgotten Dr. Campbell, Dr. Robert Koch is immortalized as the father of microbiology and germ theory. And the germ theory. I thought he was the father of the terrain theory. Huh. Unable to prove that a microorganism caused cholera, in the case of rabies, knowing that Pasteur was unable to even find an organism, Dr. Koch turned his attention to tuberculosis, TB. According to the historical article published in the World of Microbiology and Immunology. In 6 months, Koch succeeded in isolating a bacillus from tissues of humans and animals infected with tuberculosis. In 1882, he published a paper declaring that this bacillus met his four conditions. That is, it was isolated from diseased animals. It was grown in the pure culture. It was transferred to a healthy animal who then developed the disease. And it was isolated from the animal infected by the cultured organism. When he presented his findings before the Physiological Society in Berlin on March 24, he held the audience spellbound. So logical and thorough was his delivery of this important finding. This day has come to be known as the modern day bacteriology was born. In 1905, Dr. Koch received the Nobel Prize for proving that TB was an infectious disease. Except he didn't. In fact, he couldn't find an organism in infected tissue only by using special staining methods after the tissue was heated and dehydrated with alcohol. He poisoned it and killed it. That's what he did. The stain was a toxic dye, methane blue. And the solution he used, another toxin, potassium hydroxide, LYE. When he injected the organism stained with these poisons into animals, they got sick. But what caused the illness, the bacillus or the poisons? And TB does not satisfy Koch's first postulate. Only one person in 10 who test positively for TB actually develops the disease. Those who don't are said to have latent TB. Even in the 1930s and 40s, some scientists remained skeptical of the germ theory for TB. Many still believe that the cause was genetic. An investigator who disputed both theories was the dentist Weston A. Price, author of the groundbreaking book Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. During the 30s and 40s, he traveled around the globe to study the health of so-called primitive peoples. Living on ancestral diets, as a dentist, he naturally observed dental and facial formation and the presence of or absence of tooth decay. He found 14 groups in regions as diverse as the Swiss Alps, the Outer Hebrides, Alaska, South America, Australia, and the South Seas, in which every member of the tribe or village exhibited wide facial structure, naturally straight teeth, and freedom from tooth decay. He also noted the absence of disease in those well-nourished groups. As soon as the displaced foods of modern commerce made inroads into the population, they became vulnerable to both chronic and infectious disease. especially TB, the children born to those who adopted the Western diet of sanitary processed foods. Sugar, white flour, canned foods, and vegetable oils were born with more narrow faces, crowded and crooked teeth, pinched nasal passages, narrow configuration of the birth canal, and less robust body formation. Okay. Mark my spot here and take the last break for the show. I guess a couple short songs. Be right back in a few minutes, everyone.
The love of God has been extended to a fallen race through Christ the Savior of all men. There's hope in saving grace.
Okay, and we are going to continue on about the last 20 minutes or so of the show. I can find my correct page. I got a bookmark around there, and I still can't get the right page. Price rejected the notion that TB was inherited or caused by a microorganism transmissible by droplets released into the air and in the coughs and sneezes of the infected. He surmised that the root cause was a malformation of the lungs, similar to the narrowing of the facial structure and dental formalities. In those born to parents eating processed foods. In a visit to a pediatric TB ward in Hawaii, he noted that every patient had dental formalities. These dental formalities did not cause TB or, I'm sorry, these dental formalities did not cause TB, of course, but Dr. Price believed that the same conditions that prevented the optimal formation of the facial bones also prevented optimal formation of the lungs. It was the dead and dying tissue in the lungs that attracted bacteria, nature's cleanup crew, and not the microorganism that caused the disease. He noted that Swiss villagers living off their native diets of raw dairy products, sourdough rye bread, and some meat
and organ meats had no TB. And this was the time when TB was the number one killer in Switzerland and elsewhere. Likewise, inhabitants of Lewis Island in the Outer Hebrides were free of TB. Their nutrient-dense diet consisted of seafood, including fish livers, fish liver oil, along with oat porridge and oat cakes. They lived in thatched houses that had no chimneys, living in close quarters with smoky polluted air night and day. Still, they had no TB. When modern foods made their appearance, the situation changed and TB took hold. Health workers blamed that smoky air in their cottages, not the microorganisms, and made them install chimneys. But to no avail, only Winston A. Price was curious about the fact that the well-nourished islanders were immune, even when living in smoke-filled houses. Similarly, he observed that African tribesmen living on traditional foods seemed immune to the diseases in Africa, even though they went barefoot, drank unsanitary water, and lived in areas that swarmed with mosquitoes. Europeans visiting Africa needed to cover themselves completely and sleep under protective netting to avoid disease. Once the continent of Africa became coca colonized, these diseases proliferated among the Africans. During the time of Dr. Price's research, it was only the so-called infectious disease of Africa that struck terror in American minds. It was polio, according to health officials, that was an infectious virus. This virus didn't just make people, especially young people, sick. It occasionally left them crippled. Pictures of grown men in iron lungs and children wearing leg braces seared the national consciousness. No, it could have been all of the body sprays that they used. Those go back a long, long time, Luca. Body sprays. Washing of clothes with detergents. I lost my spot, Luca. In the mid-1950s, physician Morton S. Biskind testified before Congress. Dr. Biskind's message was not what the legislators wanted to hear. Polio was a result of central nervous system poison, not a virus. And the chief central nervous system poison of the day was a chemical called... I've never been able to say the word, but it's commonly known as DDT. Used in World War II to control mosquitoes said to cause malaria and typhus among civilians and troops. Its inventor, Paul Hermann Muller, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1948 for his discovery of the high efficiency of DDT as a contact poison against several arthropods. By October 1945, DDT was available for public sale in the United States. Government and industry promoted its use as an agricultural and household pesticide, really promoted it. Photographs from the era showed housewives filling their houses with DDT fog, dairy farmers dusting crops in their sorry, dairy farmers dusting cows in their cow sheds, even spraying in the milk, crop dusters depositing DDT on fields and forests and children on beaches, enveloped in the pesticide. An attachment for your mower could distribute DDT over your lawn, and trucks spray DDT on city streets. Children cheerfully played in the spray. DDT largely replaced another CNS poison, lead arsenic, introduced in 1898 for use in crops and orchards. Before that, the preferred spray was plain arsenic. Biskin wrote, in 1945, against the advice of investigators who had studied the pharmacology of the compound and found it dangerous for all forms of life, DDT was released in the United States and other countries for general use by the public as an insecticide. It was also known by 1945 that DDT is stored in the body fat of mammals and appears in the milk. With this foreknowledge, the series of catastrophic events that followed the most intensive campaign of mass poisoning in known human history should not have surprised the experts, yet fat from admitting a casual relationship so obvious that in any other field of biology, it would be instantly accepted. Virtually the entire apparatus of communication, lay and scientific alike, has been devoted to denying, concealing, suppressing, distorting, and attempts to convert into its opposite. The overwhelming evidence, libel, slander, and economic boycott have not been overlooked in this campaign. In early 1949, as a result of studies during the previous year, the author published reports implicating DDT preparations in the syndrome widely attributed to virus X in man and X disease in cattle, and often fatal syndromes in dogs and cats. The relationship was promptly denied by government officials, who provided no evidence to contest the author's observations, but relied solely on the prestige of government authority and sheer numbers of experts and to bolster their position. X disease, studied by the author following known exposure to DDT and related compounds and over again in the same patients, each time following known exposure. We have described the syndrome as follows. In acute exasperations, mild clonic convulsions involving mainly the legs have been observed. Several young children exposed to DDT develop a limp lasting from 2-3 days to a week or more. You're scaring everybody, Luca. Be nice. Or is it me scaring everybody reading this? I don't know. One of us got to stop. Particularly relevant in recent aspects of this problem are neglected. Studies by Lilly and his collaborators of the National Institutes of Health, published in 1944 and 1947 respectively, which showed that DDT may produce degeneration of the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord in animals. These changes do not occur regularly in exposed animals any more than they do in human beings, but they do appear often enough to be significant. When the population is exposed to a chemical agent known to produce in animals lesions in the spinal cord resembling those in human polio, and therefore the latter disease increases sharply in incidence and maintains its epidemic character year after year, it is unreasonable to suspect an etiological relationship. Investigators. Okay. Thank you there, Luca. Investigator Jim West unearthed Biskind's writings and testimony along with other reports about the effects of poisons on the CNS dating from the mid-19th century. West compiled the following graphs noting the correlation of pesticide used and polio evidence in the United States. As the use of DDT in the United States declined, so did the incidences of polio. Vaccination programs were introduced at the same time and take credit for the decline. West says, a clear, direct, one-on-one relationship between pesticides and polio over a period of 30 years, with pesticides preceding polio incidents in the context of the central nervous system, related physiology, leaves little room for complicated virus arguments. Even as a cofactor, unless there exists a rigorous proof for virus causation, polio shows no movement independent from pesticide movement, as one would expect if it were caused by a virus. Both the medical and the popular imaginations are haunted by the image of a virus that invades or infects and begins replicating to the point of producing disease. You gonna do some research on it there, Luca? In the laboratory, however, poliovirus does not easily behave in such a predatory manner. Laboratory attempts to demonstrate causation are performed under conditions which are extremely artificial and aberrant. West notes that in 1908 through 1909, German researchers, Landsteiner and Popper in Germany, claim they have isolated poliovirus and used it to cause polio in monkeys. Their method was to inject pulverized puree of diseased brain tissue into the brains of two monkeys. One monkey died and the other was sickened. Headlines trumpeted this proof of poliovirus causation. The weakness of this method is obvious to everyone except certain viral pathologists, said West. Never has polio contagion passed muster with Rivers' postulates. The injection of puree of diseased brain into the brains of dogs was a method preferred by Louis Pasteur to establish microbial causation of rabies. And indeed, injecting smushed brains into the heads were often made them foam at the mouth and die. Many of Pasteur's contemporaries disagreed strongly that rabies, also called hydrophobia, was a contagious disease and pointed out that the vaccine often caused great harm to animals and people. Even Pasteur's contemporary germ theorist Robert Koch discouraged the use of the rabies vaccine. Vets of the era believe that dogs became rabid when they were starved and mistreated. Dr. Matthew Woods of Philadelphia noted that at the top of Philadelphia dog pound were an average of more than 6,000 vagrant dogs are taken annually, and where the catcher and keepers are frequently bitten while handling them. None of them, not one case of hydrophobia, rabies, has occurred during this entire history of 25 years, in which time 150 dogs have been handled. During the 1960s, researchers succeeded in inducing symptoms of rabies in experimental animals by putting them in bat caverns, where they could breathe the toxic stultifying vapors of bat guano. Later, claiming to have isolated an airborne rabies virus to test whether the so-called virus caused rabies, one researcher inoculated mice 50% died within 48 hours, but none developed rabies. As for polio, even with worldwide vaccination programs, polio has not gone away, either in the United States or in third world countries. Today in the United States, it has received a new name, acute fluid paralysis, AFP. That's nice. Displaying symptoms identically to polio, with over 200 cases recorded in 2018. Many parents have observed that the condition appears after a vaccination. CDC's pathetic advice. To prevent infections in general, persons should stay home if they are ill. Wash their hands, often with soap and water. Avoid close contact, such as touching, shaking hands with those who are ill, and clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces. In some areas of the world, such as India and Africa, the incidence of acute flaccid paralysis has skyrocketed, which many blame on campaigns to administer experimental polio vaccines to children ages 0 to 5. Indian researchers described this strong correlation in a 2019 publication in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, and calculated that countrywide from 2000 to 2017 there were an additional 491,000 paralyzed children, in excess of the expected numbers. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys suggests that far from credit for eliminating childhood paralysis going to vaccination campaigns, there is strong evidence pointing to the likelihood of experimental polio vaccines is related to the sharp rise of AFP. Sometimes I wish these books were on PDF so I could just scroll instead of having to turn the pages. If the true cause of epidemics is exposure to electric pollution or toxins from insects, industrial poisons, toxins produced by bacteria under conditions of filth, vaccinations and drugs with substandard nutrition as a cofactor, what about the outbreaks of disease in the Americas, in Africa, and in the South Seas? When these aboriginal peoples first met the European colonists, didn't they begin to suffer from infectious disease as soon as they came in contact with infectious diseases carried to the New World on boats from the Old World, diseases to which they had no immunity? Actually, native peoples did not contract disease immediately on contact with the Europeans. For example, fishermen and early explorers visited the northeastern waters along the Atlantic coast during the 15th and 16th centuries. Yet we have no historical commentary on the existence of disease or epidemics among the Aboriginal people during that time. According to Raymond Abumsawan, in his report, Historical and Scientific Perspectives on the Health of Canada's First Peoples, since the prime purpose of this early contact was to commercially exploit natural resources, any visible evidence of the physical weakness or sickness of the indigenous inhabitants would surely have existed, seen keen interest. Instead of these early reports marveled at the Native Americans' good health and robust constitutions. So I think, I'm going to stop right there, everyone. I guess a few of you knew the end was coming right there. Must have looked at the clocks. You're supposed to wait for me to tell you, Annie. But not going to play a tune at the end here, so I'm just going to drop the stream for you, Annie, and let you take it over. So thanks, everybody, for coming out. And hope to see you back tomorrow with me and Roger.